This is the Thanks for Sharing podcast, the podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship.
Remember to subscribe and download episodes in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on the Podbean app.
You can find more Thanks for Sharing at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/healingpaths. That's path with an S.
Hello and welcome to the Thanks for Sharing podcast. I'm John T.
And I'm Jackie P.
Today on our show, we have a guest. His name is Dan Doty, and he hosts the Everyman podcast, which I understand is not just a podcast. Dan, you guys do retreats and other things like that too.
Yeah. Everyman is a business with a bunch of other elements too.
Podcast. It's kind of a movement you're starting, right?
Yeah. Yes, I would like to call it that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's call it that.
I could get behind that movement. I've been, since Jackie told me that you were going to be on the show, I've been listening to the podcast and I've been thinking, these are the conversations, the types of conversations I've wanted to have with male friends, but it usually turns to like, what do you do for work? Who lives by you? What kind of fertilizer do you use on your lawn? Like, so I've really appreciated what you're doing on the show and how in depth that goes. I've really liked listening to those other men's stories.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah. It's been fun. And, I'm that same way. I have a hard time with surface conversations that last too long. And, I find, you know, the more and more I do this, the more depth and, you know, openness and directness that I have with people in general, the more, I don't know, alive and energetic I feel too. Mm-hmm. And with guys, I think that is what every man is all about. It's that offering the, first of all, giving permission to men that they can have feelings and they can have wants. And second, honestly, helping them practice do that. And in doing so, connect to each other, you know, in a much more deep and authentic way, and connect to themselves in a big way too. So yeah, it's been a dream of mine. It's pretty amazing what we're doing so far. And I appreciate that it's resonating.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
You mentioned, because I met you the first part of May, and was that close to when you launched it?
That was 2 days after we launched it.
Okay,
that was right after we launched. Yeah, so I was on the
and
Joe
things
Rogan.
Things were starting to explode pretty quickly.
Yeah. So we were, Jackie and I were on a retreat in Malibu, and you know, on this retreat, we were not intended to be on our phones very much. We wanted to be fully present for what was going on. And yeah, the day before, 2 days before, I had been on the Joe Rogan Experience podcast, which reaches 11 million people per month and growing fast. And overnight, I had hundreds and hundreds of emails in my inbox. And then we had to go on retreat and supposedly ignore that. It was tough. And so we launched the podcast on that same date in April, and got an amazing, amazing bump from the beginning where we had some real steam right out of the gate, and feel very fortunate that that's true.
Yeah, that's awesome. Nice. So tell us a little bit about who you are and kind of your story.
Yeah, happily. I grew up in North Dakota and Minnesota, basically on the border of the two states. I grew up in a rural setting, very small towns. I grew up in a town called Drayton, North Dakota for most of my childhood, and has about 600 people. And it's 30 miles from Canada and right on the Minnesota border. It is cold and flat. It is flat geographically. It is flat culturally. It's pretty flat emotionally. Very, you know, Germanic and Norwegian. And I grew up, I was a very bookish kid. I was a bit of a nerd. I became obsessed with martial arts. I joined Taekwondo when I was young. And that was my first, I found my first mentor, my Taekwondo instructor, Master Mike. He just became this superhero mentor friend figure. And I really transformed into a pretty bold and confident kid who really took it seriously and had a lot of validation from that as a young kid. And I was just kind of a normal Midwestern kid. I played football. I played in a band. I went to college in Duluth, Minnesota, and then had another big shift when I went abroad for my sophomore year. I studied abroad in England for a year and took that time to just start traveling. And it was pretty amazing. I had grown up in, you know, North Dakota and hadn't seen a whole lot. And the rest of the world seemed so massively vibrant and amazing and exciting. And so I started traveling hard in my 20s. I lived internationally a bunch. I had a lot of adventures, and I started working in wilderness therapy. So I started guiding young men on wilderness therapy trips, and spent a total of, I need to actually do a real count, but it's somewhere between 600 and 800 days out in the wilderness leading kids. And that began my obsession with men and boys and what it takes to grow up from a boy into a man, and why aren't we healthier? Why aren't we better dads? Why don't we have relationships with each other that are fulfilling and helpful and help us mature? And I found my calling there. Actually in Utah, in the desert, probably not too far from you guys.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We outside of Lehigh.
Yeah. That's not far away.
Yeah.
We have a lot of that wilderness rec stuff going on here.
Yeah, we do.
I was wondering, Dan, you'd mentioned how Taekwondo kind of transformed you. And I think it was in your first episode, or at least the first episode I listened to, you spoke to a man, and I'm not remembering his name.
Steve Wallingford. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it was Steve. Yeah. You had talked to him, and he had a similar experience that this mentor came in and taught him martial arts. Like,
yeah.
One thing that I've noticed in the men that I work with, either they, like, their body can't contain them, and they are like way beyond the space that's theirs to take up, or they can't feel their own body. So could you talk a little more about kind of that transformation and the role that Taekwondo and that physical activity took?
Yeah, totally. It's interesting. That's a great question. I don't think I've ever thought about it in those terms. I think pre-Taekwondo, I played sports. I played baseball. I think I played basketball. I loved to be outside in nature. We hunted and fished, but the discipline and the regular practice of martial arts, of Taekwondo, and I think that word, both those words, both discipline and practice, they mean so much to me as an adult right now. And I've actually never once put it in the context that when I was a 6 or 7 year old kid, I had a discipline or I had a practice, you know, like the same way now I have I work out or I meditate or I go to yoga. Like, these are my practices. I think I had that from a very young age, and I was a pudgy little guy, an awkward little guy. And I don't know, I was able to, I believe, let the energy, I don't know, my like basic boy energy, my kid energy, really turn it up strongly, you know, and really let it move my body, and became comfortable with, I was not an aggressive boy at all. I was not an aggressive kid. I was a very, very opposite. And I'm pretty grateful that the Taekwondo allowed me to, I don't know, own that part of myself or have some of that. I just sort of picturing myself. I had this bright red, or not bright, but red hair. And I had my dad cut it in a flat top with a flat top comb, like flat on the top, flat on both sides. And I had giant glasses and freckles everywhere. And like my belly looked like a muffin top spilling over my Taekwondo pants. But even with all of that, I felt unstoppable. You know, I felt you know, we would yell when we'd kick and yell, you know, like the martial arts sales. Oh man, I would just give it my all, you know, I just would really let it rip. So I don't know if that answers your question. I feel like I was probably in the way that you set it up, I probably was not filling my body totally, as opposed to the other way around. And I think that the practice of Taekwondo really, probably helped me fill up in a strong way.
Yeah. I think that physical aspect, for men, and I've noticed for me, like the times when I'm feeling more kind of stable and more, emotionally complete. There's a real physical component to that too. It's not just talking about feelings or sharing stories. There's really using my body and using that in a way that is helpful to me. And yeah.
Yeah. So the basic protocols of every man and the groups that I lead and the retreats that I do and all of these trips are we practice somatic awareness. We practice physiological awareness as our sort of base play. That's where we start. Mm-hmm. We start with, you know, checking in with our bodies. What are we noticing? What are we feeling? And then, you know, evolve that into partnering it and complementing it with our emotional state too. You know, and what I keep telling everybody, and I think this is sort of clarifying as we go, but the core of what we do at Every Man is really provide an opportunity to become more comfortable with whatever it is that we're experiencing. And what I'm finding, and what we're finding, and I think what has been found is that for guys, we jump out of our experience because we're not comfortable with the emotional components, and B, we're not comfortable with the associated physical components. You know, there's been some amazing research you guys are probably aware of, or maybe aware of how our emotions land in the body and how those physical sensations of those emotions are so uncomfortable that we can't stick with them, you know? Yeah. So in a sense, I feel it's remedial. What we do with emotions and the physiological stuff is remedial with the intention to just be okay with what's happening, with the experience of what's happening. So.
Yeah.
I've heard you talk, Dan, and talk about how for men, a lot of the messaging that men get through, you know, messaging around masculinity, particularly American masculinity and what that looks like or what that's supposed to feel like for men today, that men often have these internal spaces within them that they're just not supposed to go. Whether that's, you know, their own power, you know, sometimes I think as a female, we're afraid of feminine power, but I think a lot of times now there's a lot of messages that tell men that they should be afraid of their power too. So whether that's their power, whether that's their emotions, whether that's their sadness, that there's just a lot of messages that say to men, there are places within you that you should not go.
Absolutely. I picture a spectrum, like a whole spectrum of human experience and, you know, what we can experience as a human. And I think the label of American male is like a very confined little, you know, band within that wide spectrum. I think you're totally right. One of the things that seems very apparent to me right now is that there's this belief that, I don't know what the right, maybe you guys can help me come up with the right word, but it's almost a either or black and white scenario. So that if you're a man and you're strong and confident and sure of yourself, then it seems to be a belief and messaging that you can't also be sad and weak and scared. And the dichotomy there, or that sort of flipping back and forth that you can't be more than one thing at a time, I think is really hamstringing males in general, because, and you're totally right. What we're doing is making I feel like if I was going to give out a resume today, it has two things on it. It's one, I can create a safe space for people, and two, we can basically be there with whatever comes up, right? Mm-hmm. I guess that's the safety part. But I didn't think I was nervous, but I'm actually blanking on the second resume skill.
So, while you're collecting your thoughts, I will say I think that's one of the things that I've not just really heard from you, but I've also felt it in the week that we spent together in Malibu, and what you and Lucas were going to be interviewing him on the podcast. And then the other men that were just there, it's this challenge that you guys were able to bring for men in the group. I mean, you allowed us as women to be real too, but it was this challenge to the men in the group to open up and to be real. And I think sometimes in our society that being real has an expectation, like what this is what actually supposed to be there. So when you do open up, this is what you have to be, and this is what we have to find.
Yes.
And what I have felt from you and Lucas and the other men in that group was that you truly do mean when you open up and get real, real is whatever is there.
Yeah. Yes.
Without expectation, yes. Without scripts and definitions. It's just, this is what is there. And what can you do with that?
Exactly. 100%. The big change that my big dream, what I would love to make a change culturally and help make this change, is to move away from a prescriptive narrative of what manhood is and what masculinity is to a descriptive one. And it's exactly what you're saying there. And it's that I don't think it's functional anymore for us to say what a man is. You know, I this gets a little iffy, but maybe at all, right? I mean, you could list some qualities. A man is kind, a man is strong, a man is generous, whatever. You can come up with whatever your list is. But then you're already caught in that bind of prescribing what you're supposed to feel and who you're supposed to be. And I feel like the narrative moving forward that I think is more powerful and more applicable is that the only measure of manhood or masculinity that we could even offer anymore would be, how willing are you to be yourself in that moment? How willing are you to just, you know, be with others and experience yourself, experience others? And how aligned are you with your, how congruent are you inside and outside? Yeah.
I'm curious if you're okay sharing this. I'm curious a little more about your own story and maybe what some of those moments were where you really had to kind of challenge the prescription and just be authentically you.
Yeah, totally. One of the most important people in my life was my high school girlfriend. Her name was Sally. And the family I grew up in was, I'm very, very lucky and grateful. I had a family with so much love and so much care and support, and but we didn't have much physical touch. We didn't have much sort of emotional back and forth. We just didn't, you know, it just wasn't a part of our family. And my high school girlfriend, Sally, came from a family that was so warm and loving and vibrant and sort of effusive with their love. And that was a big moment for me to really spend time with her and her family, where it was just like something of a shock. It was like, whoa, you know, they say they love each other all the time. They hug each other all the time. They share when they're upset with each other. They say it out loud. This was shocking to me. And also, it felt like the biggest relief in the world to be in an environment with people where you weren't just holding so much. You weren't just holding things all the time. That was one sort of big step for me. Another was when I began working in the wilderness with young guys. I feel like up to that point I had a healthy dose of naivety. You know, I was pretty naive. I had a good, exciting life. I was really happy to be out of school. The last year, maybe 2 years of college, I had been headed on a very bookish direction. I thought I was going to be a professor. I was going to study philosophy. I was going to teach philosophy. And, you know, at that time in my life, it was really just what seemed like I should do. It seemed like the most in line with who I was. It seemed most in line with what I was passionate about. And it seemed also like very deathly not fun, like really like not what I actually wanted to be doing. And so I wound up seemingly randomly through a Craigslist ad out in the wilderness, and spent, you know, that first summer that I did this wilderness work was one of the most transformational moments for me in my life.
How old were you at that time?
I was 22, I think. Okay. 23, something like that. Just out of college, right? A year out of college. And the transformation that happened, there are a couple things. The first thing was, I had always loved nature. I'd always loved the wilderness. I'd always loved to be out, but actually, you know, being forced to spend, you know, a dozen days, you know, 100 days over the course of a handful of months, literally out there in the quiet with no distractions. It was a crash course in mindfulness. It was a crash course in, you know, I couldn't escape myself, like, at all. No. Right. I think that's some of the beauty of being out in the wilderness like that. You can't, I mean, you can spin your mind and, you know, try to distract yourself, mm-hmm. but, at the end of the day, there's really nowhere to go. And right. So I think I began to really, sink into myself at that point. And I also recognized, that I had a gift, or I had an ability to connect with these younger boys, these young men. I felt a real ability to hear them and to see them and to support them. And you know, I think I was able to make room for them. But I also had started to get this sinking feeling that my own awareness of my own emotional life and all of these things was really minimal. Like, mm-hmm. the actual, mm-hmm. Didn't have much. And I kind of buried that until my late 20s. I sat in my first men's group ever. One was in New York City, and then I quickly moved to Idaho and sat in a men's group with my mentor, Owen Marcus from Sandpoint, in his group. And that was sort of there's a couple of years there of reckoning. I'm probably 27 to 29 years old, roughly, give or take, where I thought I knew who I was. I thought I knew where I was going. I thought I knew what I wanted. And that all really, really blew up in a pretty spectacular fashion, and found myself out in Idaho sitting in this men's group, being asked to share what I felt. And in that moment, I had absolutely no idea. I couldn't decipher sadness from anger, from joy, from shame, from anything. And it was scary and powerful and helpful. And, you know, over the course of time sitting with that group and doing my own other work outside too, I found the next me, the next version of me in some mm-hmm. way.
Which I think is so great, because oftentimes I find people, and maybe men particularly, when they're faced with that moment where there's a question and there's kind of this awareness that I have no idea how to answer this question. I have no idea. Yeah. They will fill that space up so quickly with so many things so that never happens again.
Anything. Fill it with anything.
Yes. Yeah. And a bunch of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Life. I think we fill it with life a lot of time, you know? No, it's massively uncomfortable to sit mm-hmm. there. I think, you know, what I coach guys to do as much as possible in that moment is start with saying that, you know, I mean, there's this masculine male thing in our culture that says we're supposed to know what to do. We're supposed mm-hmm. to have an answer. We're supposed to figure it out. But dang, is it powerful just to let yourself be uncomfortable and say, hey, this scares the crap out of me. I have no idea what to do right now.
Well, and I found, I mean, I live in this culture as a female. And so one of the messages, you know, that I would hear as a female about men is that men were supposed to be this warrior in my life, which there was a time in my life that I was like, that sounds great.
Right.
Somebody else, like my protection, all of those hard, difficult things that scare me, that's now on somebody else.
Right.
And they have to show up, you know, my husband, because he was my warrior, right? So my husband
has to.
That's
why you get one.
Right? I found one, so it's him, like it or not. All of that had to go to him. And what I found after, you know, several years is that really didn't work for him, and it didn't work for me. It robbed me of my own personal development. But it robbed us of this relationship in which he could say, I don't know, or I'm scared, right? Like that he could really be this person, not this warrior or not this superhero, you know, because for me as a female, that's what a lot of that sounded like, as I'm being told what the role that men played in my life sounded a lot like a superhero. And right. I would love to have a superhero in my life, but they're not real.
Yeah.
And what I have found as I was able to let him step out of that role of being everything and all things at all times, we really found a relationship with each other that was very connecting, because both of us could be authentic. And I would add, then I also had to pick up responsibility for my own life. And I had to learn how to embrace my power. I had to learn how to be strong and vulnerable and excited and aggressive or assertive.
Yeah.
I had to learn all of that for me, which was a gift.
Yeah. So what was, I'm curious, what was your, what was the other side of the coin? If he was a superhero, what was the female role in that, situation?
Well, then my job was to be attractive and sweet and the damsel in distress, which, I mean, you know me a little bit. I don't do that super well.
Yeah.
But that would be my role, right? Like, I've just got to kind of take that princess role, and he has to be the knight in shining armor.
Yeah, I wonder what it was that made the culture or the messaging say that it had to be that way all the time, you know, or that was like, if that's the way it is, because of sometimes, I mean, you know, with my wife, Elise, like, there are moments where I do get to be the superhero, you know, and it's awesome, but yeah, not all the time. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I don't know where that belief or expectation would have come from, that that's just how it always had to be. That's not human.
No. Well, and it's not like he doesn't have strengths that I love and appreciate and that he gets to use. And I also do. So when the moment calls, both of us can rush in and save the day.
Yeah.
But it's not expected that we have to do that when we aren't capable of it.
I like what you said about your experience in group, that you had to find the next version of you, which to me implies that there were updates since then. Like, that wasn't the version that you landed on, and that was Dan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Lots. I mean, all the time, man.
Because I think that's part of that development and ability to be us. Like, I know for me, when I sit in a therapy room with clients for 8 to 10 hours a day, I come out a different person every day. That impacts me. And if I have space to be growing and changing and evolving, that works for me. If I don't have space, if I have to come and hold the exact ground that I left that morning, that kind of shuts us down. And I think for, you know, as Jackie's pointing out, for men and women, both in our society, I think that this is what you have to be at all times and in all places. That's really stifling.
Yeah, it's totally stifling. And, you know, I know, actually, I always wonder, like, does it work for people? You know, how well does that actually work?
I was talking to a guy in my neighborhood last night. My kids are going to take care of his bunny rabbits while they're on a vacation. And he was saying, so you're a therapist, right? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, so what do you do? And I was telling him, and he said, do you ever just want to look at people and say, just go watch an episode or two of Leave It to Beaver and try to live as close to that as possible and you'll probably be okay. And I started laughing. He's like, what's so funny? And I was like, this is life according to Dave, right? And he's like, well, I think it's a pretty good model to follow. That's what I try to do. And I thought, like, knowing the guy, is like, okay, maybe that works for you. But the vast majority of people that I meet, they can't do Leave It to Beaver.
Right. And there's a lot more complexity.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's so curious to me. I think that, yeah, man, if it does work for somebody, great, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it allows you to live in harmony with others and you know, fulfilled and doing great and you don't have any internal resistance to it, man, that sounds pretty awesome and easy.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Go for it. But yeah, my reality has never been that. My wife and I always joke and we look at each other and say, man, we are complicated people, and it just doesn't you know, but I don't, you know, I don't know. I don't know if we're any more complicated than anybody else. I think we're, mm-hmm. we're aware of our, complicatedness, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes a world of difference for men, you know, as a sex addiction therapist, when my male clients are talking to me and they're like, all I need is this with sex. And I'll talk to them and say, I think you're really underselling the emotional being that you are. And the mental being that you are, it's not just all about the physical. And that really gets a lot of them thinking, like, maybe that's one of the first times in their life they heard somebody say, you're more than just your body, or you're more than just, you know, the physical attributes that make you male. And it really kind of starts to open up this world, like, yeah, what am I like emotionally? And what are my needs emotionally? And what is the story that speaks to my emotions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I, and like, you know, like we said, and which I think is just sort of common in our culture, if our life is a song and we have the control board to all the dials for all the melodies and all the different parts, all the tracks that got recorded, that emotional track for each of us, for most men, a lot of times is really just subdued, right? Or it's turned down enough so that you can't actually hear it amongst all the other parts. And my experience and my belief is it's actually not true. You know, I mean, whatever we do with that part of ourselves, I think it'd be really hard to ever say that it doesn't actually exist.
Yeah.
It's so fundamental to being a human being. And again, I don't have any clinical background. That's not me. And maybe there are folks out there that, you know, have different relationships to their emotional parts of themselves that I'm not aware of and I don't understand. But for your average guy who comes into one of our groups, there is a dissonance between, you know, what they are feeling in a deep way, but don't really maybe quite grasp or don't quite have a handle on or don't have access to, and you know, what they present in normal life. And so it really goes to the core of what we do is we just create a space to say, hey, let's explore that. You know, here, we're not going to judge each, you know, we're going to do our best to be honest and not judge each other and have, you know, we're all here doing this together. And we're going to explore that. And we're going to speak some of the stuff it's scary to speak. And once we do that, we see the massive benefit that comes from it. The thing that I'm finding words to say better and better, but I mean the way that things change for guys that come into our groups is astounding. It's monumental. It's amazing to one guy, I won't say his name, but you know, was in a job that, this is recent, this is the last 6 months, a guy came into our group and really, really, really needed to not be in his job anymore. Mm-hmm. Just a toxic environment. And he was just terrified and, you know, scared of doing his own thing. And he had a possibility of starting his own business. He'd been thinking about it for years, I think literally 2 or 3 years. And, you know, he got down into our group and just asked him the simple questions. Well, you know, what are you feeling? What is under there? And it just felt like a door opened and he stepped through it and it could never be shut. And, you know, within, I think 6 weeks, he had started his own business and
he's
killing it. And he's, you know, he comes in more relaxed and more confident and it's just beautiful. It's just like so amazing to be a part of, you know?
So. Could you talk a little more about some of the experiences that you see the men you work with needing to have to get access to that emotional control panel? Like, what are some of the things that start to unlock that?
Yeah, great. I think the first one for that I believe in and that we use a lot is the somatic and body piece. So we start our meetings with a 5-minute, body scan meditation check-in where we just go through our bodies, open up our awareness of that. And maybe even before that, I think the simplest and biggest thing is just slowing down and taking a moment out of life where you consciously, you know, with others' help, say, okay, here in this chunk, I'm actually just going to really slow down And I mean, that in itself allows you to feel what you feel more, you know, when you become aware of how fast our minds are moving and how quickly the thoughts are revolving, and then say, okay, hold on, what's going on down here? What's going on with the rest of me? And that, man, I think that's sort of square one, right? Mm-hmm. So just taking the conscious time to slow down enough and mm-hmm. tune in. And then beyond that, the things that I see happening all the time are, so our groups are organized by a set of agreements. We read these and we say, you know, we are going to follow these agreements in our time together. And there are things like speaking from our own experience. There are things from, you know, when we practice this embodied connection. So as we speak, we talk about, you know, as I say this, my belly feels tense, or, you know, I'm noticing that I feel sad as I go into this. And we set up this dynamic where the rest of the guys in the group are empowered and emboldened to give feedback really in the moment. So say I'm sharing in the group and I'm not all that present and I start spinning out on a story or analyzing or explaining, you know, any one of the 10 guys or 8 guys in the group is comfortable saying, hey, Dan, I feel like I lost you. I'm not really feeling or resonating with what you're saying. You know, can you go back to the feeling of where you're at? And so it's this amazing team practice, right? It's this amazing sort of team dynamic mindfulness practice that, and it's at times, you know, sometimes it's confronting and challenging. Sometimes it's very gentle. And generally the tone is just, you know, loving and caring and fun. And there's usually a lot of laughter and sometimes a lot of tears and sometimes not. But it comes down to the agreements of these simple protocols of being present with our bodies and our emotions and really learning to practice sharing from that place and listening from that place too.
Yeah.
I love that. I find that, you know, regardless of how much meditation I do or how much therapy I do, I still have this tendency to get annoyed sometimes. And one of the things that I found, and this is kind of what you were saying that you practice in your group, is if I can talk about whatever it is that's annoying me. You know, if somebody's just going on and going from one thing to the next, and if I could say something like, hey, I feel like I lost you. Can you come back?
Yes.
Right? My annoyance tends to go down a lot because I spoke to it, not in a way that was threatening or attacking, but I find so often also in our culture, I think because we are so disconnected from our emotions and our body, we don't know how to give feedback in a way that it can be heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or we don't know how to hear feedback from other people without spiraling us into shame and like, oh my gosh, they saw me ramble on and get lost. How embarrassing is that? And instead we can just be like, oh, thanks. Yeah, I did get off in the weeds. Thanks for bringing me back.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of my favorite things we did at the retreat in Malibu mm-hmm. together with the direct feedback session and the practice and sort of the setup of how to do that in a positive way. And that's hugely helpful. One of the podcasts we have up is with Rourke Denver, who's a commander of the Navy SEALs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are some really interesting corollaries between these every man in the men's groups and sort of your special forces, special operators like the SEALs. I have a returned special forces guy in my group here in Bozeman, and we're sort of beginning to sort of open up a relationship with that, with more guys in that world. But the thing about the feedback is that in those tight knit teams, those, you know, very high performing teams of the special forces and Navy SEALs, Rourke talked about the constant check that men have with each other and on each other. You know, it is like a constant feedback loop of testing yourself and you know, if you need improvement in one area, somebody will say it immediately, you know. Mm-hmm. if it's an immediate feedback loop, and with that immediate feedback, I think with feedback in general, it's, I mean, you have something to go on, right? You have something to work with. And Rourke made an amazing point in the podcast, I thought, just about how, you know, if you're a lone wolf and you're out there and you have all these ideas about yourself of how you think you show up to other people and how you are, who you are. But if it's never honestly reflected back to you, mm-hmm. It can be a complete fabrication, right? Or, you know, I don't know if maybe that's too strong fabrication, but something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's such an important element for men kind of becoming, if I can use the term, real men, or the best men that they can be, mm-hmm. you know, because that cultural toxic masculinity message is you're supposed to have this figured out. You're supposed mm-hmm. to know what you're doing. And if you don't, that means you're really, really messing up. So, you know, I know for me, getting to a place where I'm recognizing I'm at a dead end, I need help. Like mm-hmm. there's layers and layers of messages I have to cut through to realize that that's actually what's going on, is that I need help and I need some feedback, or I need to bounce something off of somebody else because I've got too many blind spots going on. And for me, kind of coming into more of my emotional journey, I think that opening myself up to feedback has been one of the harder parts.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's never comfortable. I mean, Jackie, in our workshop, it was super uncomfortable for me there too. But you know, I've done it so many times that I welcome that discomfort. You know,
I mean, right.
And it was, you know, I practice this more in the context of men, and it's really comfortable and easy for me to hear from guys, and being with women and men in that retreat was really, really helpful and powerful to
yeah.
me to get that from both sides. You know.
Yeah. Same for me.
Yeah. The what just came up when you were sharing there was I can't, like, the belief that we were supposed to have it figured out and know how to do everything, and you know, it is astounding and mind-blowing to me that is the belief. I mean, how arrogant could anybody be ever to think that they know what the hell they're doing with everything? That it's I don't know. I have a hard time, you know, legitimizing where that came from. I don't know. That's so arrogant. There's no humility in that thought.
Well, and that point always makes me laugh, because what I saw growing up from my father, he's a civil engineer and he's a really smart guy, you know, has figured out a lot of problems, but anytime something broke at our house or needed repair, he'd quote unquote figure it out. Mm-hmm. And it was usually, you know, 3 weeks later it needed attention again. And my wife's dad, he's a painting contractor, and he's restored their home. It was like built in 1847 or something. He's restored it. And I remember one of the first times I was looking at his bookshelf, I saw this like good housekeeping home repair manual. And I remember thinking to myself, people know how to do this and they've written books. Like there's a knowledge base for this.
They aren't just born with it.
Right. Because I felt like that was what was expected, is I was just supposed to be able to look at this, and whether it was something mechanical or something emotional, relational, I was supposed to just be able to pick it apart and understand the pieces and know how to put it back together.
Yeah. I mean, and there's good qualities there, right? I think to be able to step in a situation and trust yourself and learn what you need to, like, of course, that's great. Like we should all have some of that in us. Right. And taking it to the extreme though is, you know, there's some really amazing studies and research and books in just the whole tribe sort of phenomenon that's mm-hmm. been coming out about how, you know, really the neuroscience that's showing that humans, we like actually are pack animals. We are mm-hmm. social beings, right? There's these fight or flight or safety loops in us that, mm-hmm. that really can't be relaxed until we know our place with the others around us. And it's this lone wolf mentality for men, it's hurting, like actually hurting, mm-hmm. and even killing. You know, it's making us physically unhealthy, it's making us medically unhealthy, it's making us emotionally, it is killing and hurting us. We're committing suicide. Mm-hmm. We are doing way too many drugs and things like this. We are, you know, it comes out in all these ways, and it's not just us, right? Like when that happens to us, we hurt our families, we hurt mm-hmm. our loved ones. ourselves. We're ignoring the needs of others around us just because we don't have access. And it's, I mean, I'm making a case, and I don't know how big I want to make it yet, but I think it's fundamentally one of the bigger issues of our time right now. Yeah. Really, I think that if men could step into a more open and relaxed and real version, I mean, the economic benefits, the political, I don't know, just the whole spectrum. I believe it's a big deal. I really mm-hmm. do. I'm kind of formulating my argument around that, but we need each other, you know, and to think otherwise, it's not working anymore. It's just not working.
Yeah. Well, and whether it's like physically killing in terms of addiction or depression, suicide, or like the guy that you were talking about, just going to his work every day, a part of him was dying. Like
yes.
he was not living his life.
No.
And one of the things that I find, John and I are starting a therapy group here, and really the focus is developing meaningful relationships with men. Mm. And as we talk to clients about that, so many of them will open up and talk about how they long for that, how much they really need that. And it reminds me, you know, we used to have this neighbor that lived next door to us, and he lived by us for, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years until they moved. And he and my husband never really talked. We'd see them a lot. They'd say hello, but they never really talked. And in the process of them moving, his wife came over and said, "Hey, we need a ladder." And, you know, my husband was like, "What size? 'Cause I have like 4. So like, what size do you need?" And, she said, "I don't know. Let me ask my husband." She's like, "My husband was too afraid to come ask you."
Yeah.
And, you know, my husband was just like, "Why?" And she said, "Well, he just looks in your garage and he's so intimidated by all the stuff that you have, you know." My husband kind of laughed and was like, "Well, I'm intimidated by his really clean garage, because like he has nothing in his garage and it's so clean, and I have like one of everything and it's not so clean." And they, in that process, started talking.
Yeah.
And it was really kind of sad because both of them were like, "Oh, but you're moving." And mm-hmm. we just now started talking. And we just now got past our assumptions, got past whatever intimidated us, and started getting real with each other.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking. It's mm-hmm. heartbreaking. Statistically, men, adult men, don't have friends. They don't. Yeah. They don't have friends. That's sad. That's really sad. Mm-hmm. It's not okay. You know,
Or they have friends that they go do stuff with, but they don't really talk to them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. They don't. Yeah. The, you know, concept of meaningful relationships, or, you know, deep meaningful relationships, is not something that we look at guys and measure, like, you mm-hmm. know, but, and, you know, listen, like I said, I shared where this started when I was younger, and I worked with young guys. I worked with teens, adolescents, and young adults. And, you know, it just, I think that it's not just friendships though, right? It's relationships in general. Mm-hmm. It's men's quality and depth of relationships in general. You know, I have a 1-year-old son. He was born a year and 10 days ago. And, I just can't picture at this time giving him what he needs as a young human child, mm-hmm. Without access to my emotional range and without the ability to actually be willing and desiring to connect, you know, with him. And you know, the concept of mentorship and the concept of, you know, I don't know, just teachers and any adults who are in that position to connect with kids. What I felt as a younger adult when I was working with these kids, it was like, wow, our teachers, our people who are working with kids directly, you know, man, they're not really connecting to these kids. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not really, really offering themselves in much of an open way. There's this role thing, right? So I'm an adult and I have my crap together, and you're a kid, and, mm-hmm. you know, we're going to play this game. And it didn't, you know, from an earlier age, I just saw that. I'm like, man, that doesn't work very good. Like,
right.
it doesn't offer. I just could see and feel the spectrum of natural human maturation, you know, like what we need to grow as a human and grow up and be an adult and be healthy. And it just felt like, well, boy, you know, I looked back at my high school teachers. I was like, well, you guys sure didn't offer me much, you know, and I get it. And I don't carry any anger about it, but well, not much anyway, but it's just that role playing thing. And I think it happens on all levels. So men as fathers, men as friends, men as husbands, men as professionals, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. You going to say something?
I was just going to ask, you know, what, Dan, what would you say to the man who is kind of in that stuck place in life and realizing they need something more, like what's kind of your call to action, or here's the next step? I'm really glad that you spoke to your vision of the place that men need to have in our society. So like, how would you say you get that guy from that stuck place to being part of that transforming our culture?
Yeah. So, you know, at Everyman, we're building an offering, which is going to include a simple and direct way to create and form your own peer-led men's group wherever you are. And we're building a website where you can find these groups, and we're going to setting up a mentoring process for guys who want to start groups to teach them the skills and give them the background. And we're going to create an online community that supports each other in doing this. We have weekend retreats. We have longer wilderness-based expeditions. We have the podcast, which is, you know, can maybe start getting some of these thoughts and feelings brewing. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, I feel like, you know, therapy or counseling in general is incredibly important. I think that, you know, small things like, I don't know, any positive health based thing is a step in the right direction. So, you know, a good yoga class or meditation or just going to the gym or any of these, are these all good? But I guess the call to action truly would be, you know, when you hear the message that you have an emotional reality and you have an inner reality, pause and take that seriously and allow that to actually be there, and, you know, try not to just cover it up with the next thought. And the two questions that we use as the base of our stuff is what do you feel and what do you want? You know, we kind of always go back to that. It's just really simple. It's really, really direct. So mm-hmm. I think those are questions you can ask yourself.
Yeah.
And then just know that there's a literally a movement of men. Like I've been on the phone the last couple of weeks with literally guys all over the world starting groups in Australia and Canada and Scotland, all over the States. And, you know, there's kind of a wakening up to this. And so mm-hmm. know that you're not alone, and know that it's just, you know, there's this you that, that you could let, you know, out. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That reminds me, Dan, as you were talking at the retreat that we were at, and one of the things that I was in a group with you, and one of the things that we had facilitated, we asked one of the men there, I think we asked him, what do you need? But kind of along the line of, what do you want?
Yes.
And he literally broke down and sobbed.
That's all it took.
And said, nobody has ever asked me that. Like, everybody's told me what they need, but nobody has asked me what I need. And I love that. I love that this movement is starting and it's resonating with men, because I do believe too, we need this, and it will make a difference. I know you've got one of your longer retreats, or what do you call it? One of your longer intensive coming up. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so there's an expedition. So we call the Long Ones Expeditions. We're doing a Yellowstone. The Everyman Yellowstone Expedition starts on August 27th. It's a 7-day backcountry trip. Guys fly into Bozeman here, and we have about a day of orientation and really diving into our protocols and getting our you know, vulnerable depth and authenticity on. Then we're doing a 4-night backcountry trip within the bounds of Yellowstone National Park, which is really special. Exciting, you know, the wildlife and the legitimacy of that. We're going to climb Electric Peak, which is the tallest peak in the Gallatin Range, and then we're going to you know, really just dive deep, and I'm calling it, you know, the biggest inner and outer adventure that you, that you can find at the same time. Yeah. And this is my dream truly coming true. Like ever since I was in the wilderness therapy world, I wanted to be able to offer this kind of transformative experience based in the wilderness, based in the outdoors. And I am so excited about it. We have a handful of our seats getting filled right now. We have about 5 or 6 left. I'm super excited about that.
And so for people who want to join the expedition, they can find out about that where?
On our website. It's everyman.co. That's everyman.co. So there's a missing an E in the every. And there's an expedition tab in there, and it gives all the information and a link to the sign up page.
We'll put that on our podcast link. And then if they can't join the expedition this year but wanted to start on a smaller scale, when will your online community and mentoring be up and going?
So it's up and going. We're just not fully lifted off with the technology part. But right now you can go on our website again and click on the groups tab, and you can just send a message through there, which will go right to me and say, "Hey, I'm interested in finding a group or starting a group." Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we'll put you in the database and we'll connect you to guys in your area. And so it is, we're operating right now. We're starting groups all over the place. I think probably in about a month's time, we'll be fully on board with our website. It's just, all it's going to do is make it a lot more efficient.
And they can also find you on your podcast, Talking with Other Men, Starting the Process. And that's the Everyman Podcast.
Exactly. Everyman Podcast, a new episode is released every Tuesday. And yeah, it's a long form dialogue podcast where I use some of the similar protocols in these talks as we do in our groups. And it really is about, you know, diving deeper into guys' experience and guys' stories in a way that, you know, basically the podcast is out there to say that we don't have to only go to a guru or somebody that holds the knowledge to tell us how to do things. It's that if we simply show up and share with each other in a real way, you know, that gives so much guidance and direction and ideas. So,
yeah, I believe that. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on our podcast. It was always good to connect with you. See you again.
Yeah. Thank you guys. It was fun. I appreciate it.
That's great work you're doing. And we, thanks for your time. We want to remind our audience, remember that your story matters, and remember there's something meaningful in every chapter. Don't wait to share your story with us. Don't wait to share your story until it's finished.
You can share your story with us on our Facebook page, Healing Paths, Inc., or on our website, www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. Good to see you.
Yep. Thanks. Bye, guys.
Okay. Bye.
See ya.
This podcast is solely for the purpose of information and entertainment and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help.
At the end of another episode, we want to remind you that nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress.
Remember the prayer of the perfectionist. Help me remember I can't do it all. Help me to take things one step at a time, and that the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me.
Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me to be able to separate all that I'm learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone, that I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastery. I am enough. Amen.